Welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by the Plan B Network and Bitbox. This is Chapter 6 of Sovereignty Through Mathematics. I'm Knut Svanholm, and I'm here, as always, with my partner in victimless crime, Luke the Wolf. Yes, how are you today, Luke?
Wow, that was unexpected and delightful. I'm wonderful, Knut. Good evening. How are you?
Good evening. How am I? I'm all good. Good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Excited to be here. The Academy episodes are always fun.
Yes, they are. And this is the one about what Americans call scarcity, what Brits call scarcity, and what pirates call scarcity. Yes.
Well, we're sure in a good mood today. Before we dive in, just a reminder, if you'd like to get involved, join the Academy, get involved in the discussion, and maybe even join the episodes while we're recording them, go to our Geyser page. You'll get all the info about how to join the Academy. That's geyser.fund/project/infinity. All the info is there. So just take a look. Anything to add, Knut?
No, come join us. We have fun here.
We have fun here, as you can tell. Okay, I think I'll just dive into the chapter, Scarcity, Chapter 6 of Sovereignty Through Mathematics. What makes a commodity scarce? What is scarcity in the first place? What other properties can be deducted from an object's scarcity? How are scarcity, energy, time, and value connected? Scarcity might seem easy to describe on the surface, but in reality, it's not. Not when you take infinity into account. Infinity is a concept that has puzzled the human mind for as long as it has been able to imagine it, if it ever has. It is a very abstract concept, and it's always linked to time, simply because even imagining an infinite number would take an infinite amount of time. If we truly live in an infinite universe, scarcity cannot exist. If something exists in an infinite universe, an infinite number of copies of this something must also exist, since the profitability of this being true would also be infinite in an infinite universe. Therefore, scarcity must always be defined within a set framework. No frame, no scarcity. Knut?
Yeah, this is a long and convoluted way to say that scarcity is always local. There's a difference between finiteness and scarcity, or finity, maybe. Like, whoa, is that even a word? Finity?
Sure.
As opposed to the opposite of infinity. Let's say finiteness, maybe.
Finiteness, I think, is the real word, yes.
Yeah, so I'd say, like, scarcity, this is, as I said, this long and convoluted way of saying that scarcity is local. Like, what matters is something is scarce in relation to the sum total of that thing.
Okay, yeah. So this is a framing device, basically. The concept of scarcity is what we're tackling, right?
Yeah, so like this is also alluding to the age-old fact that there's an ever-increasing amount of fiat, there's an ever-increasing amount of crypto, and there's a limited amount of Bitcoin. It's very different in that sense.
You're jumping ahead just a little bit here. Yeah. But I think a point on this is definitely that I think the idea of something being infinite or that it can go on and on and on is also something that we don't really think about. Like it's kind of the inflation problem, right? Like we basically have an issue that technically the money supply or money supplies can go on forever. Right. But we don't perceive that. Right. Like the imagining the infinite number would take an infinite amount of time. That specifically, I think, is the point to get across here. Like we don't intuit that something could go on forever and ever.
No. It's literally impossible to wrap your head around. Like and there's so much written on the concept of infinity. And it's like just purely mathematically is such an interesting concept. I don't know if this the probability of something being true is exactly spot on, but I see in some sense it is. Like if you have an infinite amount of time to go look for something in an infinite space, and other stuff exists in that space somewhere, that sort of implies that you will find another Earth at some point. But yeah, let's not get into the whole philosophical, mathematical infinity concept. Hotel Infinity. What's it called? The Hillebrand's Hotel, right? Where there's an infinite amount of rooms, and if all the rooms are full and there's one more guest, you can still fit them in by just moving everyone into like room two instead of room one and so on. And if there's an infinite amount of guests, yet another infinite amount of guests, you can fix the problem by moving everyone into even numbers and then put all the new guests into odd numbered rooms. So there are so many weird things, properties of infinity and different sizes of infinities and stuff like that. But we're not going into that here. It's not the gist of the chapter.
Sure.
Okay. It's just me being a physics nerd here or something.
Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe let's see where this goes after the next paragraph or two.
Yeah, sure.
Think of it this way. The most expensive artwork ever sold at the time of writing was the Salvator Mundi, painted by Leonardo da Vinci. It's not even a particularly beautiful painting, so why the high price? Because da Vinci originals are scarce. A poster of the painting isn't expensive at all, but the original will cost you at least $450 million. All because we agree to frame its scarcity around the notion that it is a da Vinci original, of which under 20 exist today. Historically, scarcity has always been framed around real-world limits to the supply of a good. Most of the great thinkers of the Austrian School of Economics from the 20th century believed that the value of a monetary good arises from its scarcity, and that scarcity is always connected to the real-world availability of that good. Most of them believed that a gold standard would be the hardest form of money that we would ever see, and the closest thing to an absolutely scarce resource as we would ever know. Okay, so now I think we're into the connection to currency and Bitcoin.
Yeah, absolutely. And today I probably would have used the word finiteness instead of scarcity here. But it's still, yeah, alluding to this Bitcoin is not gold 2.0 thought. Like Bitcoin is much, much, much more finite than gold. Finding new gold is only a matter of how much money you put into finding new gold, whereas it doesn't matter how much money you put into trying to find another Bitcoin, you still won't find more than 21 million of them. Yeah, and we get into what that actually means later on in the chapter, so I won't spoil it too early this time.
Well, and again, I think here one of the points is definitely about that the limits to the supply of a good. That's the key point here that basically got broken with fiat currency generally. That the ability for a government to print money in the easy way of looking at it, or allow a lower interest rate on loans that just get created out of thin air by the fiat of a central bank, those are the limits that were taken off of the monetary system. And now we're basically seeing the effects of that.
There's a great Rothbard book called the What Has Government Done to Our Money, I think is the title, where he explains how all inflation is theft, like that you can't get around that it's theft. Like, as we've discussed before, fiat was born as like receipts for things you had in a vault, so like mostly gold. If you had a certain amount of gold in a vault somewhere, the receipt for the gold was like the first monetary bill. People realized that they could trade the receipts instead of trade the actual gold itself, which is much heavier to carry around and harder, not as divisible and so on. But if you can't get the gold back, you are being stolen from. And there's like no excuses for that, even though modern monetary theory and Keynesian economics makes up all kinds of excuses for why it's okay to inflate the money supply. But it simply isn't. Not if your goal is sound money, like not if your goal is to have a proper form of money.
Right. And I think in the next paragraph here, we're going to transition from gold to Bitcoin. So should we just do that?
Absolutely.
Okay. In the late 90s, the cryptographers that laid the groundwork for what would become Bitcoin reimagined scarcity as anything with an unforgeable costliness. This mindset is key to understanding the connection between scarcity and value. Anything can be viewed as scarce if it's sufficiently hard to produce and hard to fake the production cost of. In other words, easy to verify the validity of. The zeros at the beginning of a hashed Bitcoin block are the proof of work that proves that the created coins in that block were costly to produce. People who promote the idea that the mining algorithm used to produce Bitcoin could be more environmentally friendly or streamlined are either deliberately lying or missing the point. The energy expenditure is the very thing that gives the token its value because it provides proof to the network that enough computing power was sacrificed in order to keep the network sufficiently decentralized and thus resistant to change. Easy to verify is the flip side of the unforgeable costliness coin. The validity of a Bitcoin block is very easy to verify since all you need to do is look at its hash, make sure the block is part of the strongest chain, and that it conforms to all consensus rules. In order to check whether a gold bar is real or not, you probably need to trust a third party. Fiat money often comes with a plethora of water stamps, holograms, and metal stripes. So in a sense, they're hard to forge. What you cannot know about a fiat currency at any given moment, though, is how much of it is in circulation. What you do know about fiat currencies is that they're not scarce. Now we're into the meat of it.
Yeah, this unforgeable costliness being the flip side of the easy to verify coin. I really like that. If you understand what a hashing algorithm is and how hard it is to find a number beginning with that many zeros, and if you know about the difficulty adjustment algorithm and like how your miners, how many guesses miners guess each second. I think I talked to Bob Burnett about this. It's like, he said something like these miners only produce like 200 exahashes or something like that, which is like, was like 200 million million guesses per second. It's like, it's retarded much if you really unpack what it is. So if you understand that, it's very easy to see that there's an extremely high possibility or high probability that a ton of work was put into finding the block. This is alluding to that, I guess, and like pointing that out.
Well, you're basically describing in layman's terms, public-private key cryptography, which Bitcoin uses strongly. Bitcoin wouldn't exist without this cryptography.
Yeah, but this is not private public key, right? This is just the hashing.
You're right. It's the hashing. It's the hashing. Yeah. But you can validate the information just by looking at the results of the hash, and the hash itself is hard to do.
Yeah, and you can unpack the hash and find the block and see what's in it and make sure that it is a proper Bitcoin block.
Exactly. They are related concepts, though, because you need a private key to be able to sign the messages that go into Bitcoin, but you can use its public key that is derived from the private key as verification. So essentially, yeah. It works in layman's terms as far as describing these difficult things to understand about Bitcoin, basically.
Yeah, I think a very good way to explain it to the uninitiated is to call it a one-way mathematical formula, like something you can calculate this way, but you can't do the reverse calculation. You cannot derive the private key from the public one, but you can derive the public one from the private one.
Yes, exactly. And the reason that's important, and I mean, the entire modern world is based on this type of encryption. And in fact, the SHA-256 encryption algorithm is one of the primary ones.
Which is also why quantum FUD is so funny, because at least in Bitcoin we have 10 minutes to fix the problem. The banking system does not. Like, everything goes to shit if that's
exactly. And then you only have 10. You have 10 minutes to get into the next block, and so the fees on that block are going to be just insane. Insane. Yeah. They might even be close to infinite. Like, yeah. they might be close to the value of the Bitcoins that are trying to get moved. You know, when Satoshi's coins finally move, when the quantum computing is hacked.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll worry about that when that day happens. And I don't think I personally don't believe that's anytime soon.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you.
It's sort of the same type of scaremongering as AI will be sentient and we will have Skynet starting a war against humanity any day now. It's one of those headline-y science things where like everyone's a FUD salesman. Have you thought about this? What everyone is selling is FUD. A hardware wallet is FUD. Like a bank account is FUD. Like quantum resistance is FUD. Like everyone's who tries to bring you a message of any kind is always selling FUD to a certain extent. Like even if you just someone sells you a comic book, you can see that as FUD as well, because they're like, you are going to be bored. You need to read this comic book, otherwise you will be bored. Like it's still FUD. I don't know where I'm going with that, but I'm just saying that I don't believe quantum computing will be a problem for Bitcoin anytime soon.
Definitely, I did not expect you to link Donald Duck comics to quantum computing.
Donald Duck comics was in my first article about Bitcoin I ever wrote. It was about the question of the article was like, what would you rather own? The world's first Donald Duck comic or the world's best Donald Duck comic book. And the reasoning is like, yeah, of course you want the first one because that's more objectively valuable than the best one, because best is such a subjective measure anyway. And that's also like the parallel is, of course, Bitcoin and the other shitcoins.
Yeah. You as a Swede definitely had to have made a Donald Duck comic reference in your first article.
Yeah. That's, Donald Duck was big in Sweden. Like
bigger comic in Finland, words. Basically. Yeah. Still is. The other point that you made that was, I think, pretty important here is the difference between gold. The verificability. That word? Verificability.
I love that word. Verificability.
Yeah. Of gold is, well, you essentially have to melt it down. But with Bitcoin, you can just validate it yourself. You can run the blockchain on your node and validate it yourself by checking it against the consensus rules. Gold is not possible. You can be pretty sure, but weighing it doesn't work. Could be tungsten.
Yeah. Right? Well, this is allegedly where the term sound money comes from, but I've been informed that that is not a fact at all, but just a rumor that it was because of the literal sound the gold coin made when you threw it to the floor or dropped it to the floor, so you could detect if it was the correct material. But I don't buy that.
I've heard the same one. I've also heard the same reason that it's not that, but whatever. People have been faking gold and silver since its beginning, and yeah, being able to shave little bits off of coins, you can't do that with Bitcoin. You can literally take a fee and give someone slightly less of a UTXO, but that's completely transparent.
Yeah, what you can do is sell paper Bitcoin, which is not Bitcoin.
No, so, sure, but if it lands on the blockchain in a valid block, that's it.
Yeah,
that's it. Can't fake
absolutely
that.
Absolutely. No.
Can't fake that.
Oh, by the way, did you see the meme about, we talked about the difficulty adjustment algorithm here, and you saw that meme with two circles, a Venn diagram, and in one is like people who oppose Bitcoin, in the other is people who understand the difficulty adjustment algorithm, and then the intersection is like no one I ever met. And I agree with that totally. I have never encountered a person who can explain the difficulty adjustment algorithm and is also against Bitcoin. Those people don't exist.
Yep. Fantastic point. Shall we continue the discussion?
Sure.
Bitcoin provides us with absolute scarcity for the first time in human history. It is a remarkable breakthrough. Even though you can't make jewelry or anything else out of Bitcoin, its total supply is fixed. After the year 2140, after the last Bitcoin has been mined, the total amount of Bitcoin in circulation can only go down. This limited supply is what the gold standards of the past were there for in the first place. Bitcoin supply is much more limited than that of gold, however, since they will be lost as time goes by. Since the supply is so limited, it doesn't matter what the current demand is. The potential upside to its value is literally limitless due to this relationship between supply and demand. The backing that other currencies have is only there to assume people that the currency will keep its value over time. And the only way of ensuring this is to limit the supply. Bitcoin does this better than any other thing before it. Leonardo da Vinci's original paintings are extremely valuable because of Leonardo's brand name and the fact that there are only about 13 of them left. One day, there will be less than one left. The same is true for Bitcoin.
Yeah, imagine that. What year do you think we're in when there's just one Bitcoin left?
Probably pretty far into the future.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. Like, and this is so mind bending. It reminds me of something Michael Dunworth said in a panel in Sydney here when I was in Sydney a couple of months back. That Bitcoin is the first thing that humans have built but cannot destroy, and I love that framing, which is also why I really like viewing it as a discovery. And not something humans built or invented, but something humans discovered, because I think it is an agreement on a fixed set of rules. It's more of a way to communicate that we have discovered, a way to communicate that makes theft or makes lying too costly. If you view it that way, it's much easier to understand why there can't be more than 21 million. It's literally because we agree that they shouldn't be. Humans have decided that. And we define a Bitcoin as a 1/21 millionth of the total supply that will ever be. Or something close to that anyway. That's not the exact formula, but anyway, there's something there.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the idea that there's going to be only one Bitcoin left, I have a feeling unit bias will win the day at some point before that happens. Like at some point, there will be a code change to declare that when there is 1 million left, or say 21 million sats, we're just going to call those the Bitcoin again and add 8 decimal places. And that'll work.
I'd say that my node would not run that fork. Like I would not buy that chain. Like I would not agree to that.
You don't think so? Just to fix the unit bias, because that's what I'm talking about.
But we're fixing, like, unit bias is like built into the system. It has happened over and over again. We're talking sats now and not Bitcoin, right?
Exactly.
And there are multiple, like, this is another thing I did in Lugano 2 years ago, right? Where the debate between Cavallo and Adam Back and Giacomo, where we're discussing the sats versus bits debate, you know, the big, like,
yes,
what are we calling
one.
This and what are we calling that? But I am not of the opinion that we need to change anything ever. Unit bias, it's for people who like XRP. Like, I don't believe in unit bias. Not in that sense. Like, I believe that clever enough people will be able to figure it out anyway.
Fair enough. I think we're going to need more decimal places eventually.
Yeah, but that will require a hard fork, right?
Probably. I suppose it will.
Yeah. And that to me, that wouldn't be Bitcoin. I don't see Bitcoin ever hard forking again, really.
Well,
like, maybe. But these things are hard to say, and it's hard to say beforehand. But right now, the system functions around the Satoshi, which is 100 millionth of a Bitcoin, and there's no changing that anytime soon, I believe.
No, I agree with you. It is definitely quite the interesting idea, though, that there will only be one left kicking around just from them being lost.
It's also, you can also say that none of them can be lost, that they always exist. It's just that what people lose are private keys. The private keys can be lost from an individual perspective, but they do still exist, like, in a sense.
Then again, the coins tied to UTXOs still will all exist, but the number of them that can actually move. So maybe we won't ever know that.
No, and this is also what we mean by exist. Do numbers even exist? Like, Bitcoin is very abstract sometimes, and especially when you dissect it and deep dive into what it actually is. It's just a string of ones and zeros, like switches that are on or off.
Okay. On to the next one. Scarcity on the internet was long believed to be an impossible invention, and it took a multi-talented genius such as Satoshi Nakamoto to figure out all the different parts that make Bitcoin so much more than the sum of them. His disappearance from the project was one such part, maybe the most important one. The thing about computerized scarcity is that it was a one-time invention. Once it was invented, the invention could not be recreated. That's just the nature of data. Computers are designed to be able to replicate any data set any number of times. This is true for every piece of code there is, and digital scarcity needed to be framed somehow to work. Bitcoin's consensus rules provided such a frame. Bitcoin certainly seems to provide true digital scarcity, and if the game theoretical theories that it builds on are correct, its promise of an ever-increasing value will be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah, that should make the bullish in the room pretty excited.
Yeah, and it's also like this is an idea embryo that has been that is refined in the later books, right? This one in particular is what turned into the one-shot principle in the second book, where I call it resistance to replicability instead of computerized scarcity, which is a weird term. The only thing this is a way to make something uncopyable over the internet, really. Like something you cannot copy in the realm of computers. That's what intrigued me in the first place about Bitcoin. It's not like monetary stuff. It's like, holy shit, like, are you telling me that there's a thing now on computers that cannot be copied? Like, I couldn't wrap my head around that. That's very strange. But it's like inverting the very purpose of computing power and deliberately using as much of it as possible to do absolutely nothing except guessing the wrong number over and over again until you find the right one. So it's a completely new way, a novel way of using computers and looking at computing power. So like instead of actually making the computer solve something. Like, it's always advertised that as Bitcoin miners solve really complicated mathematical problems. They do not. They guess a number. There's mathematics involved, but it's not super complicated. It's somewhat complicated if you're a layman, but at the end of the day, they're guessing a number. And most of those guesses are wrong. So they're most, and you can view that as waste, but it's just a different way of using computing power. Sacrificing something to create something that is finite and cannot be copied, that is scarce.
You know, even the terminology of guessing a number is sort of not 100% correct. It's running an algorithm, and it's more like it's comparing the results of that algorithm to a threshold. So
yeah,
the guessing a number is sort of the very last step, I guess, of the algorithm is that you take the result and compare it to the current threshold.
Yeah. The guessing the number is the number you guess is the nonce. And then when you hash the whole thing, you see if that was the correct number to guess. So that's where
there we go. That number guess. That's fair. That's fair. Well, and the thing here, one of the interesting things here is that I remember being in a distributed computing course. I think it was 2011 or 2012. And so it knew about Bitcoin, and it covered the Byzantine generals problem, which is basically the thing that Bitcoin actually solves for, is the Byzantine generals problem. How do parties that cannot directly communicate with each other come to some kind of consensus and it's the proof of work algorithm is basically it. But I 100% recall that they said, yeah, no one's ever actually solved this problem. This problem isn't solved. And that's because technically Bitcoin isn't solving it in like a mathematical way. It's solving it in a practical way. So it hasn't proved it according to the mathematicians. It's, but it's doing it in the real world.
I love this because it's the solution to the problem is a way of communicating and not a mathematical solution. And it's so beautiful. And this problem was believed to be unsolvable for a long time. And maybe it is unsolvable. It's just that you found a way of solving mathematics without really using mathematics, if that makes any sense. It's sort of like the everything divided equation. Makes no sense mathematically, but mimetically it's did something.
No, there's something to this, and I have a feeling that they might have just been behind the curve a little bit. Like, they knew about this thing that existed. I recall that the final problem in that course was something like, make a thing, a program that can be run on multiple computers and can communicate with each other somehow. And it was interesting. Like, it's a non-trivial thing to do. But I think what they really lost, I'm pretty sure my recollection is correct here. They just didn't believe that the Byzantine generals problem was actually solved. It was practically solved, but not really solved. And I mean, I guess that's a difference between the what Bitcoin is in the real world is a lot different from sort of the, I don't know, the theoretical hypothetical stuff. It's very real. It's very practical.
Yes, it is. It's like it's clunky because of the way it upgrades and so on and so forth. But I love that quote. I think this is Tomer Strohlite, that Bitcoin never needed to be perfect. It only needed to be good enough to last forever. And that's a good way of looking at it, I think. Like, is it working? Yeah, well, then you can use it. Simple as that.
Yeah, I think that's the main points I had for this paragraph. Should we move on?
Sure.
In 2018, the inflation rate of the Venezuelan Bolivar was a staggering 80,000%. Hugo Chavez and his successor, Nicolas Maduro, effectively killed the Venezuelan economy with socialism. It has happened before, and sadly, it is likely to happen again. The main problem with socialism is not that people aren't incentivized to work in socialist countries. On the contrary, hungry people under the threat of violence tend to work harder than most. The problem with state-owned production is that there is no free market price mechanism to reflect the true demand for goods, and therefore, no way of knowing how much supply the state should produce. Everything is in constant surplus or shortage, often the latter, as the empty supermarket shelves in Venezuela depressingly attest. Chavez and Maduro attempted to rescue the country's economy by printing more money, which simply does not work. Their true motives for printing money are, of course, questionable, given that it depreciated the value of Bolivar bills to less than that of toilet paper. As mentioned in earlier chapters, inflation is the greatest hidden threat to themselves that humans have ever created. Spicy left turn here.
Yeah. Left turn in both senses. Yeah, this is one example of a hyperinflating currency. Sadly, there are many more. Turkey comes to mind, as does Argentina.
Well, but Argentina recently has the solution. Isn't it the now president of Argentina, Javier Milei, who basically said socialists are parasites who are destroying the planet, something like that?
Yes.
I forget the exact quote, but it was very, very good.
Yes. No, he's an excellent his rhetoric is excellent, and he's like he is very good at talking the talk. In my view, yet to prove if he's going to walk the walk or not. I recommend Hans Hermann Hoppe's review of Milei so far. That was very interesting.
And Milei's rebuttal is that Hoppe is a retard. So there's
that. Yeah, he said that?
Yes.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Literally.
Well, yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yes. Hoppe is many things. Retard is probably not one of them. But neither is Milei. He's not a retard either. So, and he's definitely better than everything that preceded him in that country. So we'll see how it goes. I have high hopes. Argentina is a beautiful place. So is Venezuela, by the way. But it is depressing. By the way, this is one of the reasons I continued to write about Bitcoin was a personal thing with a guy in Venezuela that sent me a DM after one of the first articles, like first 20 articles I wrote, and thanking me for helping him, motivating him to memorize 12 words and get the fuck out of the country, basically. I don't know exactly if that's what he did or if he hid a hardware wallet or something, but he used Bitcoin to save the whatever he had in Venezuela and flee to Colombia. And that just shook my soul. I thought that was, it was a fantastic experience to like, holy shit, my scribblings here from the bedroom is actually, can actually affect people's lives on the other side of the world. I was just baffled by that being the case. So that's a side note too. I mean, this whole paragraph is a bit of a side note, but it's good fun.
Oh yeah, and well, yeah, we've said before that these earlier books tend to take these side notes a little more liberally, yeah. And that's okay. And I mean, but this isn't a total side note. I mean, the thing here is that the lack of scarcity in the money supply is the problem. That's entirely what it is in these countries that hyperinflate. Like, the hyperinflation doesn't happen if you are not printing the 100 million Bolivar bill.
But also, normal, quote unquote, normal inflation is just hyperinflation in slow motion. Sooner or later, it leads to hyperinflation because it has to pick up pace since like interest on interest, like compound interest, makes the snowball effect of the money printing inevitable at some point. And yeah, you saw that during COVID, like a third of all the dollars that have ever existed were printed during COVID. Like, that's just mind-boggling to me. So it is what it is. Opt out.
Yeah. Well, the connection to socialism and Austrian economic principles and Bitcoin is one that I hope that if you're listening to this, like, we don't talk about this stuff for no reason. For me, definitely Bitcoin came first and the Austrian economic stuff came second, but the scarcity aspect of it is what got me. Like, we don't advertise it enough, us Bitcoiners. Like, no. This is the point of Bitcoin, and it stands in direct opposition to these fiat currencies that can be just printed into oblivion.
Yeah, inflation is literally the problem that Bitcoin solves. Like, you cannot make more of it, and you cannot fake it, you cannot copy it. No, and also the thing about incentives versus price signals. That's straight out of a great Ludwig von Mises book called A Theory of Capitalism and Socialism, which is a fantastic book. It's old, but it's great in describing what the problem with socialism in particular, but statism in general is.
Austrian economics. Pretty good stuff. Let's wrap this one up and cover the last paragraph. A few hundred years ago, the Catholic Church held the lion's share of political power throughout Europe. Today, power primarily resides with nation-states in collusion with multinational corporations. The separation of church and state triggered the migration of power from the former to the latter, emancipating many citizens in the process. Still, places like Venezuela are sad proof that the people are still not in power in many self-proclaimed democracies. If in any, for that matter. Another separation will have to take place first, the separation of money and state. We, the people of planet Earth, now have the means at our disposal for this separation to take place. Whether we use them or not will determine how emancipated and independent our children can and will be in the future.
Yeah, nowadays I view statism as the worst religion of them all. Maybe not of all, because there are some pretty bad ones out there, but it is a bad one. Much because it's so tempting to it's the temptation of the free lunch, right? It's people's willingness to believe that free lunches exist and that we should give out free lunches to people. But the lunches are never free. Someone has to pay for them. And redistributing wealth leads to everyone getting poorer in the end. It's just as simple as that. You get what you pay for. So if you promote laziness and not work and incentivize that, and if you disincentivize productivity, what you'll get is not productivity. You'll get the opposite. So you get what you're paying for. And this is true for politicians too. And unfortunately, this is how most countries work. Like there's high taxes and a lot of wealth redistribution, and everyone would be better off if we had lower tax rates and if any, and sound money. There's also a lot of misguided credit for why things are good. And the democracy is always like hailed as this great cure-all for all societal diseases. And sure, democracies might be less violent from a certain point of view, but from another point of view, they're not, because all taxes are violence. They're threats of violence. There's a threat of violence lurking in the background. If you don't pay your taxes, men with guns will come to your house and take you away. So it depends on how you define violence. So, and I, as you know, I find this highly fascinating. And more of this in later chapters and latter books.
Yeah, I think this is a great point. And I mean, I think the specific thing to emphasize here is the separation of money and state. That's the goal. And I mean, I'm not going to necessarily speculate as to whether we're going to get rid of the concept of the state in our lifetimes. Almost certainly not, honestly, within our lifetimes, or even within a couple of generations. But if we separate money from it, at least the ability to take away the base money from the nations and put it back into the hands of the individuals, then we change the game entirely. And states won't have the same power that they currently have.
No,
maybe they will be something to organize individuals into groups for things that require larger cooperation, especially in an era where nation states are playing war games with each other, or literally waging war against each other. But until some anarcho-capitalist utopia, maybe this is the best we can do in our lifetimes.
But I don't ever see like a world where there is no monopoly on power in geographical areas at all. That, in other words, where there are no states. I think that is a utopia, and that will never happen. But I also think that the correct thing to do is always to fight for your right to party, as the Beast Boy said, and try to make the state smaller, regardless of how small it already is. It can always be smaller. That's always the right trajectory. It's always the right vector to fight for. Like, the states can always shrink a little further. And I think it's always a good thing. Because I'm a, what they call us? Paranoid crypto anarchist psychopath or something? Yeah.
Paranoid crypto anarchist.
Yeah. Well, come to the Rockamoto in Prague.
Yeah. Or, and everywhere else for that matter. If we're still alive after Prague.
If we're still alive, yeah. We might get defenestrated.
Oh, yeah.
Speaking of, hey, I think this is a good conclusion to the chapter. And yeah, I mean, the concept of scarcity is really an important one. As I was saying, it's what got me. It's what convinced me. It's like, okay, this is the solution to the problem. I didn't realize that before. And the orange pill was pretty quick.
Yep.
After that, it was an easy pill, not a suppository.
That's good to hear. Maybe it's dissolvable?
Dissolvable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of vitamin C in orange pills, I hear.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
Anything else to add, Knut?
To the chapter? No, I think As I said, there are a lot of idea embryos in here, and we'll flesh them out even further in as we go deeper into these books. I enjoy doing that. Did we have any questions from the group this week about the chapters? I don't think so. No,
I don't think any in the main chat here. But this is a good reminder to say, hey, if you want to get involved directly, and if you want to read along and participate, if you have any specific thoughts, let us know. We have our Telegram groups. It's plural. It might be a little overly complicated, but we have a basic Bitcoin Infinity group, and then we have a group for every course that we're doing, including this one for Sovereignty Through Mathematics. And then finally, we have a group for our Mithril Adamantium members, which you can get if you join our Mithril Adamantium tier. All the information is on the Geyser Fund page, geyser.fund/project/infinity. It's the best way you can support us, and it's the best way to get involved in what we're doing here. But of course, this is all available for free on Nostr. The chapters are available on Nostr. These discussions are available on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. So please watch, listen, read, but also let us know how we're doing. Leave a comment on the YouTube, like and subscribe if you're listening or watching, and share with whoever you think might enjoy this. I know it's a bit of a different take on Bitcoin education. This isn't really a course. It's more like a seminar, right? Like a seminar series, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, I'd call it that. And and intended to be a discussion forum more and more here over time as more and more people join and we talk more about this. I mean, we discuss the idea, so that's the base layer, I guess.
That's at least something. And we agree more than we disagree. Well, duh. But we agree, like, on many of these things, we agree on everything. There are some chapters where we have the odd controversial controversial opinion on my part, usually, or I call you controversial or something like that. Yeah, usually we're in pretty lockstep on this stuff, because honestly, it is true that once you sort of understand a kind of point of view on the world, you tend to go in pretty lockstep with other people who have that viewpoint, and that's true for Bitcoin also.
Absolutely, it goes hand in hand with libertarianism. I think you can't really. You can't really, like, being an ANCAP or a libertarian in 2025 and not also being a Bitcoiner is a waste of time, in my opinion. And sort of vice versa, too. Like, sure, you can use Bitcoin and live in the fiat world still, but you're sort of missing the point if you don't do any deep dive on this. And yeah, I should also mention that my books are, there's ideas in them, and they're not necessarily like absolute truths or anything like that. I just want to make the reader think for themselves. Like, if I can manage to do that, then I'm happy. And I'm very happy that people seem to enjoy them. So, and happy to be doing this, which wouldn't, by the way, wouldn't have been possible without the Plan B Network, which is our lead sponsor for this show. The Plan B Network, you can find all sorts of courses on Bitcoin and other topics, adjacent topics as well. Right now, the Plan B Business School or Biz School of 2025 is up and running. Giacomo Zucco is still the lead of that, I guess, the lead teacher. There's a whole bunch of guest star lecturers from different Bitcoiners, including yours truly. I will be going to Lugano in June, on the 13th of June. I'll be doing a Praxeology seminar for the Plan B Network. Giacomo is right now in Japan, I believe. I think I saw pictures of him from Japan there in on X. Go to planb.network and find out more about what you can learn there, and if there's something you can sign up for. I think last year's course also, Plan Biz School, is free and open source, so that's very good.
Yeah, can't say enough good things about Plan B Network, and we're super happy to be, well, part of the network. And we'll also give a shout out to Bitbox, our favorite hardware wallet, and they've been a supporter of ours for a long time. And it's a super easy to use hardware wallet that doesn't compromise on security. Swiss built. We have a very Swiss theme to our partners here, so that's pretty awesome. And go to bitbox.swiss/infinity for all the information about the Bitbox 02. Get the Bitcoin only edition because that's, of course, the only one you need if you listen to our show.
Yeah, looks like this beautiful little thing. You do this.
Magic.
And then you plug it in.
It's good that you showed everyone how to do that.
Yes.
And of course, you can use code Infinity anywhere you like on the internet, including at Stampseed, for example, where you can get 15% off the Stampseed store with code Infinity. And at plenty of conferences, most of the conferences we're going to, if not all, for example, you're going to Ireland fairly shortly here. And then we're both going to Prague, Calgary for Bitcoin Rodeo, Riga for Baltic Honey Badger, and then, of course, BTC Hell in Helsinki. Come to that one. We're putting together the speaker schedule, so you know it's going to be interesting. I'm super excited to host everyone here in Helsinki. In just a week here, we're launching the physical store, the official pop-up store of BTC Hell, which has turned into a little office. It's pretty awesome to have a physical Bitcoin space here, a dedicated Bitcoin space in my hometown. And honestly, being a part of it is pretty damn awesome. So looking forward to that little party coming up here, and looking forward to hosting a whole ton of Bitcoiners in Helsinki here in August. So come join us for that.
Yeah, it's going to be a spectacular event. I'm looking forward to that week a lot.
Likewise, Knut. Likewise. Well, hey, this has been a fun episode. I think a topic that I hope isn't totally foreign to most of our listeners, but an important one.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And the next chapter is called. Let's see what the next chapter is called here. If I can find an index somewhere.
Holding on.
Yeah. So it's about hodling, I guess.
Is this a typo in either direction?
Holding on and hodling on.
Yeah.
Maybe we re-edited it and took away the misspelling.
I can't remember.
I don't remember. Oh, it's probably holding on. Yeah.
It was probably holding on, but I think nowadays you would write hodling on.
Yeah, probably.
Probably.
Well, yes. And we talk about GameCube in the chapter. So tune in for that one.
Tune in for that one. See you next week.
See you next time. Yep.
This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Thank you for listening.